once I put it out there that I was going to do this thing, I was like, okay, well now I have to do it because I made it, you know, I put it out there and made it real. So it kind of held me accountable.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cut to Reveal, where we talk about the editing art form and all the hurdles of that art form, career path. On today's episode, we're talking with Anthony Moreschi, who is a New England-based Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and editor. He put out his own docu-series called Don't Stand in Line, which he filmed and edited all of himself. So he comes from a very DIY or do-it-yourself background. Grew up in the punk and hardcore scene and BMX and skateboarding and whatever, and that's really like transferred to his skills as an editor and the way he thinks about his projects and whatever. And we had a very interesting conversation with him.
Yeah, we talked about film distribution because, you know, mm-hmm. he distributed Don't Stand in Line himself. Mm-hmm. And he also, you know, had used like the traditional distributing system as well in the past. So we talked about like advantages, disadvantages, you know, bad stories, good stories about that stuff. Like, it was very interesting to hear, especially, you know, for me, because like, my go-to point is where I create and I have like control over my mm-hmm. own content. Right.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I do YouTube. Right. So it was super interesting for me to hear his, you know, advantages and struggles with distribution and, running his own series, creating his own series, which is pretty cool. I only watched the first episode. I know you watched all of it, but it's interesting, definitely, especially if you are in that, like, in that niche.
It's a series about people who basically kind of go their own way, more along that DIY ethos. He offered a lot of great insight into that and into, as Peter said, the distribution thing. So with that, let's roll the tape.
So I got started editing basically through BMX and skateboarding, just from watching skate videos and BMX videos and wanting to sort of document what me and my friends were doing. At the time, that was like the late 80s, early 90s, video cameras were super expensive. Every once in a while, my dad would rent a video camera because he worked at Polaroid, so they didn't make video cameras, but he was kind of interested in all that stuff. So he would rent one, and it was like this old, it was like a camera, and it had this big giant, like, I guess it was the where you put the tape, the machine around your waist. And like, it didn't, you have to plug it into the wall. So he was renting those like when I was like in fifth grade. And then by the time I was in high school, they advanced quite a bit. So you could, you know, put a battery in it and carry it around. It wasn't. And so like for my birthday one weekend, he rented a camera and I went out and I take it out with my friends skating and stuff. And little did I know that they had actually bought it for me. So that was my birthday present. It was like the cool. It was really the best present ever. I think they realized that this was like the only thing that I was actually truly interested in that might lead to some kind of career. So that was huge. Other people have told the story many times, but I figured out how to connect that to a VCR and kind of like do rough edits back and forth. And that's what I was really interested in. I found like being able to take that footage and restructure it in a way that was different than the way you shot it. Like, I don't know. I thought that was really cool. I figured out how to lay music down on it, which by the time you got to a finished edit, it was like fourth generation of VHS quality, but it was fun. I think I even got, I had this little box I got from Radio Shack that you could put in between the VCR, like the two VCRs, and you could do like rough, like you could do like wipes and fades.
Yeah.
And like it had like like star wipes and all those kind of things. But luckily even then I realized I didn't really want to do the star wipes. I was mostly using the dissolve and maybe like a some sort of basic wipe. You know, after that, I guess I'm trying to think. Like, I went to college. They didn't have much. I went to Northeastern. They didn't really have much in terms of, like, editing programs. I think there was, at that point, Avid was fairly new. They had an Avid, and then they had this thing called Media 100, like real early non-linear editing systems. And there was two in the, on the whole campus. I got on them maybe once. They were always broken and being repaired. Mm-hmm. And then a couple years later, I ended up leaving school early and I got a job working for a place doing basically installing Media 100 systems. I was doing temp work and every day all I would do would sit online and look for any job that had anything to do with video production. And I must have applied to 1,000 places. Mm-hmm. And this one, I don't know, they gave me a shot. I kind of did the whole just fake it till you make it thing where like, mm-hmm. I don't know if I've made it yet, but you know, I just totally faked it. They're like, oh, you know how to do this? Yeah, I know everything when it comes to Macs. I know how to PCs inside it out. I never even used a real PC, I don't think. But I remember I bought one of the first Macs that had FireWire on it. I think I still have it behind me somewhere. I basically got a credit card. I bought the blue and white Mac G3 mm-hmm. and a Sony camera that had FireWire. And then I started teaching myself like a real, real old version of Premiere. Mm-hmm. And I did, this was actually before I went in to interview for the job. So by the time I went in, I had like a little bit enough that I could kind of pretend I knew my way around things. And the guy that was training me, I think kind of caught on, but it was pretty cool about it. And he's like, as long as you figure it out. And he gave me a shot and like, he was really good about teaching me stuff. So I learned, how I kind of learned. Ended up moving out to California. So, here's a big thing. At the time, DVD authoring was brand new. I had learned that working at that company. And when I left that company and moved out to California and I was driving around Costa Mesa, just happened to see on the side of the building, the big 411 video magazine logo. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but 90s, early 2000s in the skateboarding industry, that was the thing as far as skate videos go, you know, mm-hmm. talking about pre-internet and all that, like they were huge. And it was like my dream to work there. So I went in with a resume. I was like, I know how to do DVD authoring and all this stuff. And I had been working on a BMX video and I gave him a copy of that. And they ended up calling me and hiring me. That's how awesome. I got like my professional break in actually making the content. Honestly, I think they hired me because I knew how to fix the Media 100 systems and they wanted someone who worked there because at the time they were so flaky.
Yeah.
And I don't, do you guys work on those systems at all?
No, like, ever? I worked on what was called D-Vision, which became like Edit and then kind of just became obsolete. But yeah, it was around the same time as all that stuff.
I mean, there was a lot to know to configure. They were definitely not plug and play. And if something went wrong, like trying to figure it out, like troubleshooting it was crazy. The hard drives, there were SCSI drives, which were like, they used to call it SCSI voodoo. And it really was like you could restart the system 20 times, try all these different things. And on your 21st try, it might work for, even if you didn't change anything, it might just decide to work and then be fine for 6 months.
Yeah.
And look at the all, these days. Know, so. We just complain on Premiere all the time, right?
Oh, it's great. I mean, well, to be honest, I had a similar issue with my computer earlier today, but to be fair, it's because I'm running a Hackintosh. So
yeah,
it's getting Thunderbolt to work correctly on a Hackintosh is kind of like the old days of SCSI.
I have a storage unit that is supposed to be connected by Thunderbolt as well, but I'm on Windows, so it's kind of tricky to make it work as well. But it works.
Yeah,
it works
cause, now. Exactly, because I have to get it working on Windows, on the Windows side first. Yeah. And then once I get it working on Windows, I have to do this restart and just cross my fingers and hope that it comes up. I don't know. I talked for a long time. So basically, that's how I started editing. Eventually, I started editing a BMX version of their... They had me doing the DVD authoring for a while. Here's something interesting. I'm sure you guys know Jackass, obviously.
Sure.
So before Jackass, those guys did a video called CKY and CKY2K. Yeah. 4-in-1 actually distributed that, and I was in charge of the first video I actually put on a DVD was CKY2K.
Oh, really?
So,
that's amazing.
I basically, back in those days, you had to watch it a million times to make sure it encoded properly. So I watched that like that was my job for a while, basically.
Yeah.
Watching skate videos and people act like jackasses.
Dream job.
So that, yeah, that was interesting. And then I started, they wanted to do a BMX version of the video magazine they did. So I did that for a couple years, ended up moving back to and started working on some documentaries. And now I just do some of my own stuff, like for documentaries, but as I do some broadcast work and I do some corporate stuff. I have a wedding video company. I like kind of do anything you can think of aside from porn. it's not because I'm above it. Well, I've just never been, I've never been offered it. I've done pretty much anything you can think of, real estate.
Yeah.
Hopefully that wasn't too long.
No, that was good. I mean, we're kind of all the same, just kind of like getting the jobs that we can. So we can kind of like, we love editing enough that we're like, yeah, I'll edit whatever you give me because I enjoy it and stuff. And then, right.
Yeah, although I have to admit that I turned out like quite a lot of jobs during the last 3 years. I mean, not quite a lot, but you know, I turned down basically projects that weren't interesting to me. So you know, I'm on retainer with my main client, and it gives me kind of like a luxury to, you know, to say no to some things that, you know, would be additional money, but at the same time, you know, would take me away from other projects that maybe are not, you know, profitable that much, but at the same time, you know, they take me to the place where I want to be. So I think it's important to kind of like, you know, balance the whole thing as well.
I would highly recommend that. I've been lucky enough the last 4 years, my main client has me on retainer as well. You know, no offense to them, whatever, but I think they know it. It's pretty boring work. But it's a good gig because I'm on retainer. A lot of times, I mean, you get paid. I don't know about you, but I usually get paid even if I don't do that much work for them. And then, you know, 1 month it'll be slow and the next month I'll be slammed with them. But it does allow me to kind of choose things. And
yeah,
it took a while to get there. It took a good 15 years to get there. But, you know, I was a little bit lucky to
get to that point a little bit faster. Honestly, I'm like super grateful to you know, to have that client, because like, even though there are, you know, some projects that are a little bit boring as well, some of them are really, really cool actually, but I just feel grateful to have, you know, the luxury to say no to projects that I don't have to take on.
When it's all said and done, it's still, you're sitting in front of a computer playing on a computer, really, you know, you're getting paid, no matter how boring it is, it's like, it's still better than 99% of the jobs you could be doing.
I'd like to be a little bit more in the field, but maybe that's just me.
Probably last, I don't know, 10 years or so, I've been really trying to shift more towards shooting. And, you know, I usually edit the stuff I shoot as well. So it's not like I haven't been editing, but been trying to do more shooting. It's nice to get out sometimes and work on things. Honestly, I got tired of editing other people's stuff that wasn't that good.
That's why it's super interesting to me that you started, your own project, because like that's where kind of I'm like, you know, moving towards, because I actually have this, I won't like say any details because it's too early to say anything, but I have this project. I've read on some like, I don't know, some blog, I think, interview with you where you said that you had this project actually 5 years in your head before you actually acted on it in any way. And I have this project in my head as well that's close to 5 years, I think, right now in my head. I haven't done anything about it. But, you know, speaking about that aspect of me that wants to get more in the field, I feel like I should act on it eventually. So the question to you, I guess, from me is like, do you feel like you needed those years to grow up to be able to take on that project? Or do you actually regret not taking it on and acting on that idea a little bit earlier?
I would say a little of both, because I mean, I have a list. I have so many projects in my head or written down on my notes on my phone that I haven't acted on. That was like one thing that I was like, what can I do myself that I can control? Because I know we had talked about, Ricky, when you edited Holding These Moments, or if you guys had mm-hmm. experience editing feature-length documentaries. Yeah. I did two of those in the past. Mm-hmm. And I helped shoot them and edit those. And I might be drifting from the original question, but this is, to me, this was important for when you're trying to do your own projects. Mm-hmm. After doing those projects, I learned that I never want to do another documentary without a plan going into mm-hmm. it and trying to figure it out all in the edit. I mean, to some extent, yeah, that's okay. always going to happen, but it was so overwhelming. And each one took a good 3 or 4 years to complete. It was a great learning experience. But if you're going to take on a project, whether it's a feature or a short, plan it out as much as you can before even shooting. I had a list of projects and I'm looking at them and they all seem like great ideas, but I wanted to pick the one that I could plan out and sort of outline and stick to the mm-hmm. easiest. So that was the Don't Stand in Line project, because the idea was basically if I could go out and hang out with these four different people, hang out with each person for a day or two, mm-hmm. ask them all pretty much the same questions, and then just capture what happens in between mm-hmm. all that. Mm-hmm. That should be pretty easy to put together. It was a little harder than I thought, but it was still way more structured than anything else I had ever gone out and shot. And I think your question was, did I regret waiting? In a sense, I regret waiting because I could have been probably gotten a lot better. I had a lot more of my own projects under my belt. Obviously, you know, the more you do, the better you get. I think it came out a lot better because I did wait and I worked, because I was still out shooting. It was just other things. I mean, I shot, honestly, shooting weddings sounds lame, but you get really good at shooting when you have to shoot a wedding, because you don't That's get true. A second shot at it. So you can, yeah. and you can play, you can experiment. And a lot of time they want a good product, but they're not dictating how you're going to shoot and what it's all on you. Yeah. It's really yeah. that yeah. it's like shooting a documentary. So you learn a lot. I shot a bunch of broadcast stuff too, basically lifestyle shows where it's kind of low budget, just me and a couple cameras doing everything, sound, audio, lighting, if there was lighting, like everything, you know? So between those two types of things, I think I was really ready for it more than I would have been if I had tried to do it 5 years earlier.
Yeah, I get it.
And I would say, I would say like for me, really the only reason it ever materialized is because one day I just got fed up with my, like just looking at this list of things and just feeling like, just feeling lame. Like you're never going to do anything. This mm-hmm. is it. You know, like get up, you call yourself a filmmaker, but you haven't made a film in 8 years. You know, you're just doing this hired gun stuff. Like, so yeah. like in that moment, I just felt so bad about myself. I just immediately said, fuck this. And I just looked at the people that I had, who do I know well enough that'll give me the time of day to like, just trust me to do this. And I just picked four people and emailed them. And you know, it blew me away that they all agreed to do it. Like right away, they got back to me. Like, of course, that sounds awesome. Let's do it. Which I wasn't expecting really. So once I put it out there that I was going to do this thing, I was like, okay, well now I have to do it. Because yeah. I made it, you know, I put it out there and made it real. So it kind of held me accountable.
Get it?
Because otherwise it just lives in your head and it'll drive you crazy.
That's an inspiration to me as well, to some extent, because like, you know, I have this project in my head and I'm doing projects on my own. You know, that's why I kind of like started the YouTube channel for, to be able to play, yeah. you know, create something on my own. But this project that I'm thinking of, like, it's a bigger beast, and it involves more people than just me. And that's mm-hmm. always a little bit more scary than just doing, you know,
yes.
something yeah. on your own. So, yeah, I want to ask you about self-distribution, because I think you had probably good experiences, bad experiences with it. So having done that, like, what have you learned about self-distribution, and what do you wish you have done, other, you know, differently?
It's difficult. I'm not good at it. So in the past, I had done with a buddy of mine, Ian McFarlane. He directed the Godfathers of Hardcore, Agnostic mm-hmm. Front documentary, if you guys are familiar with that. We did a documentary for a band called Slapshot. and we did a documentary called Rooters, The Birth of Red Sox Nation. So those are two different experiences, but in both cases, we never saw a dime from either one of them because we went with distributors. They just, you know, same old story. They take
it. Predatory.
Yeah, you never really hear from them. And that was that, you know. So when I did this project, I decided, oh, and to back up, just to fill in the blank there with Ian, like he did the Godfathers of Hardcore. I don't know if you guys heard about the whole distributor mess where I don't know how many filmmakers got. He had gone through them and it was doing really well and he was set up to make out pretty well with it. And then the company claimed bankruptcy and everyone got screwed and never saw a dime. And it wasn't just him. It was like a couple hundred filmmakers and millions of dollars.
No, I didn't hear that.
So yeah, Google that. It's anyone who's interested in getting into trying to figure out how to make their own film and distribute it, I would recommend the Indie Film Hustle podcast. And he's got a whole, he talks about it a lot on there too. So, because I had done a couple, put out a couple of just DVDs on my own with different hardcore bands where I just sold it. I mean, this was years ago before you could do digital downloads. It was DVD. Basically, I had DVDs pressed and just sold them myself through like a PayPal website. And that went okay. I made my money back. So I figured nowadays there's companies like the one I used was Gumroad. Or Vimeo, you can sell directly. So I figured I'm going to try this first and see what I can do from it. Just try to build up a little Instagram following or Facebook or whatever. I also figured the people that I profiled have their own little following. So that might help also, which it did. You know, I basically, I mean, I sold enough to cover my hard costs, meaning travel and a little bit of equipment, you know, that was really only my cost and then a lot of my own time, but I covered that. And then I made enough to basically fund season two. That's pretty much it. it's up on Tubi. I haven't really seen anything from it. I'm told that AVOD is the way to go, but it's kind of hard to run ads. Like, cause the way I have it set up with my distributor, I don't know. Like if I run a Facebook ad, like I don't get any direct response. Like I don't know if people are watching it on Tubi for like 3 months, 3 or 4 months. Yeah. So like once a quarter I find out. And that hasn't, so I haven't been like pushing that, which so unless you have a way to drive the traffic there, you're not going to make any money. So that is kind of, I guess, my fault, but I don't really know how to go about doing it. I think I would recommend if you're going to try something, go through Film Hub, because I think Film Hub gives you better numbers, like quicker.
Yeah.
It's the same old story with distribution. Like,
Alex Ferrari has this book, right? Filmtrepreneur. We actually made a video about it.
I think
that's probably like, you know, a formula to follow, but of course it's easier, you know, to talk about this stuff than actually implement it in reality.
It's all right on. It's like everything in his book is like, it reminded me of the way we used to run bands. It's like, it's all DIY. You make your own merch. You go out and it's except digitally. That's how we were already kind of operating. Like years ago when me and Ian went with the actual distributors, we did that because we thought, well, that's what you're supposed to do. And then after that, I did a couple on my own. Like, for instance, if I sold a couple hundred DVDs directly myself, I'd make way more money than if thousands and thousands of people saw it through the distribution channels. So it sort of depends on your, I guess it depends on your goal. I mean, you could put it on YouTube and you might not see a dime from that, but you'll get way more eyeballs.
Yeah, exactly.
For me, I just wanted to make enough money to not lose money, you know. It'd be great if I could make enough money that I could do like less weddings or something like that, so I could spend more time doing this and not have it cut into my income. But
crowdfunding is like, you know, also an option, but it has its own disadvantages as well.
It's hard.
Again,
it's
like Alex's, job. Alex Ferrari's book is probably a good reference for that as well.
If anything, that book's inspiring and it kind of at least lays it out in the same way where like, oh, I could do this.
Yeah.
And then, but it's with most of those things, I mean, it says it's a hustle. So it's like a lot of work to do it, and the juice may not be worth the squeeze, or it's like something that you just like have to keep working at. And that's like one of those things. I think it's even mentioned in Don't Stand in Line. Like if this is the mission, you got to be able to fully commit to it. And if you're not, then you're going to find yourself like out in the deep end. You're going to be like, you'll be fucked. Basically, yeah. Like well, kind of what am I doing? I just spent all this time. I'm not even into this. And it's like taking up so much of my time. It's kind of exhausting to think about that. But if you're all in, then obviously it'll be a lot easier. But it's definitely, even though it's simply laid out, it's not simple.
Sometimes to my detriment, it's like, if you're not willing to do it just because you enjoy it, whether or not you make any money on the back end whether or not you pull any money out of it, right, or not, you have to be willing to do it just because you enjoy it.
Yeah.
So sometimes that hurts me. Because I'll make it, and then I just kind of forget to promote. Like, I'll make something. I've done this my whole life. Like, I make it. I feel like, oh, I made this thing, and I'm just terrible at promoting stuff. I've tried, you know, my whole life, like, the only time that anything's ever really, like, really taken off is because someone else wasn't involved in the promotion of it. And it's hard to get someone in on something like that unless it's also theirs. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Right. I feel that pain in still withholding these moments. It was really good at the beginning.
Yeah.
But now that it's like it'll be 2 years in October that we released Holding These Moments. But it's kind of the same thing that you had talked about, like the numbers with distribution, like you're seeing the analytics and you're like, oh, how can I make it relevant again, or make it so that more people will buy it and more people can see it and whatever. And it's like you're shooting in the dark. You're like, well, I think EVR put up a bunch of YouTube stuff and cool, but it's like, it's just like me telling you that this is happening, and then you just got to trust that people are going to go see it, because there's no like ticker that says, okay, ting ting ting, these are the amount of people that are seeing it. It's, you wouldn't find out until like months later.
Yeah.
And then kind of the same thing, it's like, oh well, I'm making this stuff, but self-promotion is its own job.
It's tough.
And when it's just you, it's brutal. Yeah. It can be brutal.
So the distributor I went with is Indie Rights. I don't feel like they're trying to pull a fast one on me or anything else like that, but they don't really do anything to promote. And like, they don't say they're going to either. So it's all on you. They'll put it in the channel and then you have to promote it. But to be honest with you, you can do the same exact thing yourself through Film Hub.
Yourself, yeah.
And I'm thinking about just switching over, trying to pull it and get it on Film Hub, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So that I can get that more direct feedback and figure out how to promote it. To me, I always figured, well, that's what the distributor does. It's like a record label, or like they should be promoting, you know? But apparently that's not how that works anymore.
No. To my chagrin as well, it's just like, oh yeah, they're going to help. Here's an email blast. And that's it. And you're just like, oh, wait, what? And then by that time, we figured it out. I was like, fuck, how are we going to make up for lost time and whatever? I feel like we've kind of gone off the beaten path, went down this distribution rabbit hole. So let's bring it back to editing.
I'll talk about this. I'll go way off course if you let me. So
to go back to Don't Stand in Line, when you had that idea on paper, was it kind of, did you already have it in mind that it was going to turn out the way it did? Like it was going to be the episodic and you were going to have every character within the four people that you're talking about, and they're basically like, each episode is like a theme that they're weighing in on and they're talking about. Or had you thought about it that it was going to be like a full length, and you're like, oh wait, maybe I'll just change this up? Or what was your thinking in like developing that story?
I'll be perfectly honest. Probably the first time ever that I've done something, it came out the way that I envisioned it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know if you ever heard, like, I think Ira Glass talks about the gap where you're like, you have this thing in your mind and like, but your skills don't quite match up. This is the first time I felt like my skills matched up with what was in my head. And maybe that's bad. Mm. Maybe I need to expand my head, you know, what's in my head more. But that was the way that I had planned it out. I've been watching, oh my God, way too much Netflix, I think. Just I'm like, docuseries, like, I like the idea of a docuseries. It seemed more manageable to me, I think, because I felt like a feature was overwhelming, but a 20-minute episode I could handle, like, to create. And then it's just, you know, and once you make, if you can get through one, well, you go to the next one. And it just seemed less overwhelming to me for some reason. Whereas in the end, it's longer than any, like, the other two features, and way longer. Yeah. I think because I had the stories and the plan kind of hashed out in my head before I even started, it came together like much quicker and easier.
Because you had said that you had learned from those other two features, basically plan ahead. Was there anything else in your experience working on the two features that helped you in editing or storytelling within Don't Stand in Line?
No. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. So you guys are on Premiere, right? You guys, like, if you want to get technically, I edited for years on Final Cut, old version of a Final Cut. When the new version came out, it took me a little bit, but I pretty much switched straight over to that. I was like, you know what? If I'm going to learn something new, I want to learn something entirely new. And if it's not cool, I'll just go back and use the old version of Final Cut. So, the way that Final Cut worked helped me a lot in organizing the project with the keywording and stuff like that. You can do a lot of that similar stuff in Premiere, but I think it's a little different. That helped me build out the project, if you want it, like, in technical terms. I think it would have been a lot harder for me to do it the old way that I used to work in, like, the old Final Cut. You asked me earlier about why I plan to do it as a docuseries. One reason is because I wanted to do multiple seasons. So I figured, well, if I could easily do this, I had a list of like 30 people and I picked four. I'm like, well, I can do this again. And like, I could do it with four more people if this goes well. So to go back to the editing process, now that I'm into the second season, in between season one and season two, I started to get more into Resolve as an editor. Because for season one, I used Resolve for color correction. I had started trying to edit it, season one in Resolve, and I got like a day into it, and I was like, it was too buggy and flaky at that point. But now it's like, I use it better daily for editing. I'll use Final Cut for smaller things here and there, but like on my bigger projects, like broadcast work and the documentary stuff, I'm using Resolve because the color correction is just phenomenal, what you can do with it. And I shoot most of my stuff on Blackmagic cameras. So I have the studio. I have like five versions of the studio version at this point, because I kept just buying cameras. I shoot stuff on the stuff on B-Raw, which Final Cut won't play with. And I got tired of transcoding. So I'm like, forget it. I'll just edit it all in Resolve. Again, if I'm going way off, just let me know. But the other thing, that if you guys are editing documentaries or talking head stuff, anything where you gotta, you basically come up with a radio edit, you should look into a program called Descript. It's pretty amazing. So I took all of my interviews for season two and loaded them into, basically made proxies and put them on Descript. It transcribes it. Like, you can search across all your interviews for, like, say you just want, you type it in. You just say, anytime where people are talking about skateboarding, for instance, and every instance where someone mentions skateboarding across all your interviews, it'll come up. So you can take all those little bites and grab them. You can copy the text, put it in a different, it looks like you're just editing a Word file, but it's also building a timeline underneath. Yeah, you can edit video like you're editing a Word file. And then you so it'll build it out. So you can search all your different topics and build out like a different, basically a document, what looks like a Word document with all these different topics together, but it'll give you a timeline. And then
that's crazy.
At the end of it, you can export an XML and bring that into Premiere, Resolve, whatever, Final Cut, whatever you're working with. It'll link back up to your original media, and bam, you've got your radio edit. You know, clean it up, drop in your B-roll, sweeten the audio. And it's like, when I figured out how to use it, I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, I edited season two, even though it's not fully shot, like, it's nine, you know, what's been shot, I pretty much did a radio edit for all six episodes in like a couple of days, like, as opposed to a couple of weeks.
Yeah, these days in Premiere you can also like, you know, search and you can transcribe and things like that. So that's doable in Premiere these days as well.
Okay.
But you don't have this feature where you just like, you know, select the word, delete it and things like that. I have used like this script, but a few versions ago. So I'm not familiar with the recent version of the software. Personally, I'm not in love with the concept, to be honest. I mean, not for my purposes, at least. And I don't think I would have actually approached a documentary using this script, because I think, like, in my, at least in this my opinion, like, take it with
a grain of salt. No, everyone's got their own process.
But, so. Yeah, but I like to, you know, I like to watch the footage with those ums and ooms and things like that, because sometimes these moments are actually, you know, what actuates. Oh. Yeah, you know,
100%.
Yeah.
I'll be honest. Like, a lot of times I put them back. I found, like, because I was, when I first did it, I was like, yeah, delete them all. And then I went back and I was like, no. Because you need some breathing room and you want that.
Yeah.
When I first started editing documentaries, if you go back and look even at those two features, it's like basically Franken bite the thing together so perfectly that. Mm-hmm. It was too perfect. It didn't sound real. In Don't Stand in Line, it definitely has more of that breathing. Like, there's more, I feel like I left a lot more of that breathing, that imperfect stuff that you're talking about. So I 100% agree with what you're saying about that. And I think, like you said, about Premiere, I know they have stuff like that. I wish Final Cut would have that. I wish they all had it built in. It makes a lot, and I think they will. Soon.
Yeah, they will. They will. It's to be honest, like,
I feel like something like that.
If you look at, you know, their releases and new releases and things like that, it's like they are all trying to imitate one another. Like Final Cut Pro X is probably like, you know, the only one that is like out of the line. But the rest, like, just, you know, tries to get to the same point. You know, they try to implement the same features, and like one introduces a new feature, then a year later the other adds their own, you know, their own version of that feature and things like that.
I just feel like learn them all, because when you get like I do have a client that wants stuff done in Premiere, but they don't need it done that often, so I don't even have my cloud subscription anymore because I was paying I wasn't using it that much. But, you know, if you're using all the other Adobe stuff heavily, Premiere's definitely the way to go, like, because you have that dynamic link.
No, that's a very good point. Like, you know, if you're not, like, very deep in their ecosystem, then it's much easier to switch to something else. And justifiable as well, because, like, Premiere is the most expensive one on the market. It is, like, maybe
it kind of is. I mean,
because Avid is like, I think that Avid is probably just slightly more expensive actually, but it's on the same level. But, you know, Final Cut is like, you know, one time payment, $300, right?
If you were doing it just by the math, forget about whether or not you like it or not. I paid $300 when that came out.
But
I've also had a Creative Cloud account this entire time. Like, I can't even do the math. I mean, it was like $600 a year over 10 years. Exactly. I think $6,000 to keep Premiere working. And I opened it six times in a year, maybe.
So $1,000 each time you opened it.
I mean, I would use Photoshop and Illustrator and stuff like that. But again, now I don't need those because there's other programs that I can do what I need to do. So I think they're going to need to rethink their pricing structure, unless all the other companies kind of switch, which I hope they don't.
It's all about like distribution of the market and their audience, I think. I don't think we'll see a shift in like their approach. I think we'll see a shift in what kind of user they are after and what kind of user generally like companies are after, right? So Avid is probably the best example here actually, because Avid is actually very specific about the user they're after, right? Yeah. They are only after professionals. Like they're not even trying to get, you know, beginners and like youth creators to use Avid. And I think we'll see like more polarization in that aspect where it's like, you know, one company will go after that niche, the other one after that one, and so on. I want to ask you about work-life balance? How do you deal with it? I think you have family and kids, right? I think that's why you write on the blog post. So how do you balance, you know, creating or doing your own project and working for clients and also, like, you know, having family life?
It's a struggle. I mean, I work from home like most other people these days. It's definitely a little different now than it was a couple years ago, because my wife's now also working from home full time. Luckily, we can do that. The kids are old enough, they can get on the bus and get off the bus, and we don't have to drive them to school. But I struggle with it all the time. Like, I have a client right now that it's actually a broadcast client that wants me to travel more and do more. And it's not that I can't do it, but if I do that, that's either going to take away from family time or it's going to take away from the projects that to me are more important, my own projects. But I'm balancing all these different things. I'm doing post-production for a publishing company. I'm doing weddings. I'm doing broadcast work, and I'm doing documentary work. And I'm in the process of trying to hopefully get a feature documentary funded that I can't really talk too much about. But if that goes through, it's like, okay, well, something's going to have to give. It's probably that broadcast client which is tough, because I say that, and like I came to that decision on the same day. We actually just got nominated for a couple of local Emmys, which is like, like, isn't that what you want? You know, isn't that what you dream about? Like, to me, it's like not nearly as satisfying as doing my own project. So, cause I'm still, it's like, yeah, it's great, but like, it's not nearly as fulfilling as the emails I get from people who were inspired by watching Don't Stand in Line, which the work-life balance, you know, changes, I think, over time. When my kids were younger, that's when I stopped doing my own personal stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I got married, I had kids. My daughter, who was my firstborn, is about to turn 13. I didn't do a personal project for a good 10 years just because I wanted to, I had to figure out how I was going to pay the bills and spend time with them. Now that they're a little older, I'm able to start doing that stuff. So, I mean, everyone's got to juggle it and figure it out. I don't know where you guys are at with it. I'm always curious to hear what other people have to say about it.
I don't have kids, so I don't have to worry about that.
Well, that makes it easier.
So, but I have a wife, so, and she likes family time. So I always take a break, because I, being freelance for so long and always working like 16 hours, you know, when I was single, it'd be like, okay, I'm going to sit down in the morning and then I'm going to get up and go to bed.
Yeah.
So, and now it's, you know, even though I still have that. Yeah, it's not healthy either. But also now that I have, because I can easily get into that mode, but now I'm like trying to wean myself out of that. And especially because I'm overseas and most of my clients are 8 hours behind me. So. Yeah. In a way, I'm still doing that, but I'm also like, okay, guys, it's 5 p.m. here. I'm going to go and eat dinner and hang out with my wife, and then maybe I'll be back later if you need me. So that's how I've kind of been doing it. And luckily, all of my clients in Denver and whatever are really adamant about, like, it's 11 o'clock there. You should be in bed. Stop fucking working. Get out of here. So that helps a lot, too, that people are that cool and they appreciate me and don't just think of me as, like, someone who's working for them.
Right.
Working hard. Yeah. But,
well, that's a good.
Yeah.
It was a good point about clients like that are good. And sometimes I've had clients in the past that if you behave like you're on call, they'll treat you like you're on call, like 24/7. So you have to set those boundaries. I had a client that wanted me, I mean, it was like over the weekend. It was like all like, which isn't really unusual, I guess, for what we do. But for me, it was like, no, I'm not working over the weekend. I'm not working past 5. Doesn't mean I don't ever work, but it just means I'm not there for your call and your, unless it's an emergency. You know what I mean? Like I try to set those boundaries, and it doesn't mean I don't ever work on the weekend or I don't ever work past 5, because I definitely do. But it's trying to catch up with the things that I wasn't able to do because I was dealing with clients, you know, or trying to work on my personal projects. So
having boundaries is a big one, I think. Yeah. I try to do it as well whenever I can. For me, boundaries, like, you know, they blend for my personal projects. So definitely. Mm-hmm. But for clients, I like to have boundaries and, you know, set expectations early on.
It's
because when you set expectations, it's very rarely a problem for a client. They just need to have those expectations, right? If they don't, then you may find yourself in a situation where they want you to do something when you don't want to do it, basically, because of work-life balance and respect for yourself. And you have to respect yourself. Yeah. If you don't want to be a burnout one day, you have to respect your time.
Right. I mean, the other part of it, I would, if you can, it kind of goes with it, is under promise and over deliver. So it's kind of hard for them to give you a hard, like, you know, give you shit over setting certain boundaries if you're always delivering ahead of schedule for them. They'll just kind of start to understand that you're going to do what you say you're going to do.
Yeah.
And you'll have it done. You're not going to be late. You're going to get it done. Like, and that's really what they want. I mean, a lot of times they'll be freaking out about something over the weekend that's not due for another month because they might be used to people who aren't, you know, don't deliver on time.
Yeah. Very good point. Yeah. I have had like a similar experience, I think. So yeah, we're on the same page here. Anthony, do you have like a speaking about like, you know, pages, like do you have a favorite book about filmmaking, about editing, something like that?
About editing, I haven't really read many books on editing.
That's fair.
I do.
You don't have to.
Yeah. I feel like I should. But as far as like, you know, the Filmtrepreneur is what it's called.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
one.
Rise of the Filmtrepreneur.
Gary Vee has a lot of good stuff on, you know, just marketing yourself and that kind of thing. It's not really a filmmaking book, but in general.
If you want a recommendation, then I think like Jacob Bricka's book, Documentary Editing Principles and Practice, is a good one.
Okay.
I mean, you know, doing a project like you do, I found it very inspiring. Like, you know, I felt like when I read it, I was like, God damn it, I want a doc to work on.
Yeah.
So
I just like watched, like, I definitely should read some more books on editing since it's what I do, but I watch a lot of things and honestly I just copy the cool shit that I see. I try to anyways.
Get it.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, how did they do that? I mean, that's how I figured out all of it, to be honest with you. I mean, if I go back and look at some of the stuff, the early things that I edited, the first thing I ever truly edited and put out into the world was the documentary on my band. Well, it was more of a live show. Mm-hmm. And I had like three different people in the crowd with mismatched cameras. Like nothing looked right. It was all just people who had like mini DV cameras, put them on auto and pointed them at us. So all the colors were wrong. I didn't know how to color correct. So everything's in black and white. And there's not even it's all just like dissolves the whole sh- it's like dissolve. And I don't know why I did that. I think it was because of some of the videos I was like the BMX videos I was watching at the time. That's how they did things. And I was like, that's how you do it. Like I had no idea what I was doing. I watch it now and I cringe. So, I mean, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of it is just a lot of learning is just like trial and error and imitation. The insight from why people do things, though, you can't necessarily get. That's what I think you would get from a book like that, probably. Is that correct? Like the motivation behind doing things a certain way?
Yeah, kind of. Although, like Jacob Bricka's book is very academic because he's a professor. It's written really well. It's an academic book, but in a good sense, I would say. Where you really get like a really thorough investigation of editing process for documentaries with examples, you know, with case studies, things like that. Very good stuff, really.
The biggest one that we've talked about a lot is the Walter Murch book, In the Blink of an Eye. Yeah.
It's like a series of essays about editing. And some of them are just very insightful and very interesting, like approached from a very unique angle. I think because like Walter Murch, he finds interest in so many areas that he finds connections that are kind of like invisible for most people, I think, between genres and between like, you know, areas of knowledge and things like that. So yeah. I don't know. I love this guy. I hope we get to interview him one day. That would be a highlight of my life.
Yeah. I wish, you know, that's one thing that I haven't done much is narrative stuff. I've done some commercials that were kind of narrative, but that's mm-hmm. about it. I would love to be able to do that. That's like the next thing I want to try and do, but it's a whole different ball game trying to get into that.
Just recently have I started playing with that. It's interesting because it's like, you know, when you're still used to cutting documentaries and kind of like building the story from a pile of pieces, right, and then cutting narrative, it's a totally different animal.
Actually, directions.
So, Anthony, what's next for you then?
We're still working on Don't Stand in Line season 2. I need 4 subjects. I filmed 3 of them last year. I'm hoping to film the 4th this year and just trying to keep going with that. I mean, I'd like to just keep doing that as long as people are interested in it. Because the other reason that I want to do it is I feel like it's not a one-off product. You know what I mean? So like you put, mm-hmm. you know, 3 years into a feature-length documentary, you put it out there, you promote it, and you do all this work, and then it goes and it does its thing, and then you have to start over for your next project. So I'm hoping this is like, that was the other reason I wanted to do like more of a series, because hopefully I'm not starting from scratch every time I do a new season, you know, so it can hopefully build on itself. And someone, you know, if I get to, I don't know, in 5 seasons of it, someone might be interested in a person that's in season 5 and would never have checked out any of the other ones. But now they watch season 5 and they're like, well, let's go check out what's in season 1. And they might get, you know, because that happens to me when I watch stuff on Netflix or whatever, Hulu. That's sort of the idea. So keep going with that. And
cool. So where can people follow your work and or follow you online or anything like that?
Codecprojects.com. So anyone who's familiar with editing hopefully knows what that word is. CODEC projects.com. Mm-hmm. Codec Projects on Instagram. I don't know. There's a Facebook, I think, too, but I don't really do much with it.
Well, thanks so much, Anthony, for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I love the stuff you said about self-distribution, because like I think like that's really a challenge for a lot of people, and it's good to hear about from, you know, about the experiences of people who have done it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Sometimes, Ricky, I wonder like what drives us. Because you can see that Anthony is someone who is driven. He's driven by purpose. Like, you know, the career that we took on, the editing career and filmmaking career is not an easy one. And like, I'm not the first one to say it. I'm not the first one to agree to it. It's not an easy one. But you can see that he is driven by something deeper, something inside him. And that's what I loved. That's what I loved about the interview, about like meeting him, getting to know him.
Anthony is like an everyman. He's like on our level. He's doing things himself and he's making it happen. You know, he's not a Hollywood editor like we have on the other interviews we have. So, you know, that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk with him, because he is successful in his own right. And so getting that perspective, I think, is very important, especially for something who is working. He's not standing in line. He's outside of the system.
He's not setting in line.
He's making it happen. I thought that was, and I think that's very important to hear about.
You know, whatever the level of success is, like each one of us defines his own success, right? So I think like having this asset of Don't Stand in Line that he owns, he created himself.
Yeah.
This is a huge success, like in my opinion.
We hope that you enjoyed our talk with Anthony. Have a great day, everybody. And as always, shoot and edit.
Like there is no tomorrow. And the last thing, as I always say, like send us a message. Like let us know how you like it, or ask a question for the future episodes. You can record the message with the SpeakPipe link at the bottom of the episode in the description. So do it.
Have a great day, everybody.
Have a great day. Bye-bye. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day.
If you like what you've heard, please rate, review, and subscribe on whatever podcast platform you've listened to this on.
Your reviews help more people discover this show. You can also follow us on Instagram. Just search for @CutToReveal and tell your friends.
And if you have any questions or comments, send them to podcast@cuttothepoint.com. And who knows, maybe we'll use them in the future episodes. And as we say around here, until the next time, shoot and edit like there is no tomorrow.